The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
Good evening, Douglas B. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution, KPRZ, your Christian station in San Diego County, and it is Saturday night, 9 p.m. Pacific time, so it is time for Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Now we're working our way through the Constitution in addition to other things. We're talking a little bit about biblical verses, about how Christians can be engaged in their civic responsibilities, how they ought to be, and how this all applies to the Constitution. The Constitution all applies to this, and we have made it to Article 6. This is where the federal Supremacy Clause exists, and the Supremacy Clause is one of the most represented, interpreted clauses in the United States Constitution, and the thing is about it, and this is what I want you to really understand, is the way it's being applied, the way we are being told, basically, that the federal government is supreme over everything, regardless of what the Supremacy Clause, regardless of what the Constitution actually says, because they have interpreted it that way. They're basically saying, we don't care the way it was originally intended, this is the way it is, this is the way we run it, and you're just going to have to put up and shut up, figure out a way to operate in tight, in that kind of system. I was on a radio program a week ago with the Unite IE program, good friend of mine, Greg Britton, but we tend to disagree on a few things. He's a lawyer, and he argues, hey, you know what, this is the way it is. Judicial review was one of them. Federal supremacy was another. This is the way it is. This is the way you got to do it. This is, you know, just put up and shut up. Doesn't matter what you purists think. I mean, he didn't say those exact words. That's basically the attitude. And I reject that. If we want everything to run properly, we got to go back to the original intent, how it originally operates, to say, well, this is the way it's always been because they changed it and we just been convinced it's okay, so we're just going to have to operate the way it is. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to do that, and I don't think you should have to either. So we have the Supremacy Clause that's in Article 6 that basically says, and we'll get to the reading of that. There's another clause before that, too. But it basically says that this Constitution and the laws of the United States are made in pursuance thereof. In other words, made in pursuance of the Constitution and all treaties are the supreme law of the land. I also, about a week ago, had a friend of mine, G.R. Mobley. He's behind ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, the Republic Review idea, and really activating the unorganized militias. And he also said something on my radio program that's not necessarily in line with what was intended, and we'll get into that as well, and it refers to treaties. So now that I've kind of introduced things, let's get going. Now let's back up to something that may sound familiar nowadays, but it's been around for a long time. And let me introduce it with this. They think you're an idiot. They want you to think you're an idiot. They want you to be convinced you're an idiot. They want you to believe that you know nothing and you're incapable of figuring things out. You're incapable of being informed. You're incapable of researching, but don't worry, they'll do it for you. Don't worry, they're the experts. They'll interpret everything for you, and that's the way it is. Put up and shut up. And that goes all the way back to something called the general will. The general will goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was one of the people who was behind the French Revolution. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau was essentially, before the term was really in play, a communist. He was a communitarian, a communalist, a utopianist, or at least that was the terms they used back then. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau also believed, and I guess you could say he was among the early progressives, or of that age anyway, I mean, quote-unquote progressivism, in other words, the way they think today under that name. I don't even know if that name's a good one. There's nothing progressive about it. It's all regressive. But that that line of thinking goes all the way back through history. We saw them during the Roman Empire. We saw them during the Greek states. We saw them in Babylon. We saw them in, Babel and so on and so forth. It goes all the way back. So this is nothing new. They're just rehashing what's been failing throughout history. But nonetheless, Jean-Jacques Rousseau basically believed that there must be a ruling elite, that the average person is so stupid that they're incapable of participating in a system of liberty, of individualism, of choice, of freedom. Now, obviously, when I talk about freedom, when I talk about liberty, they've also poisoned the well on that too. They want to convince you that freedom means you just do whatever you want. Well, there are rules that are established. That's why we have government. That's why we have a God. You know, rule of law, God's law is in place. There's a moral standard that's supposed to be followed. So obviously, freedom, liberty doesn't mean a free-for-all per se. But they want you to be convinced that's what it means, and therefore it's dangerous, and government must come in to moderate that. And so that's one of the word magic ploys that they use. And so here we are, trying to move forward as a system of liberty. We've got these people trying to take away your liberty. One of the ways that they do so is they try to convince you have too much liberty, and it's dangerous. And people are just able to make their own decisions, and it's dangerous, and it screws up the whole community. And that's not really the case, and that's not what a system is based on. And what they're arguing, and they're trying to add to it then, is all these immoral things that go against God's moral law and so forth, to show you what a free-for-all it is, and show you how messed up it is, and everybody's going to get angry, and everybody's going to be fighting, and everything's divisive, and everybody's battling each other, and before long, there is chaos. And in the chaos, everybody, while they're going through the chaos, starts screaming out, "We need order." Because what happens is they destroy the order with what they've done. And once there is no order, and you start crying out for order, the very people who caused the chaos then proclaim, "We will provide you with order. But if you're going to have your order, you got to have it on our terms. You have to have it on our schedule and our belief system and in our way. But don't worry, there'll be order." And then we're just happy to get the order, so we're willing to become slaves and people in bondage under this new system that's claiming to be of order. And so here you go, you head off into tyranny, and you brought it yourself. You voted it in, you embraced it, and all of that jazz. So we go back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. That's who I mentioned earlier. And when it came to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he basically taught something called the general will. The general will is this idea that there is a will of the people out there, and it's for the good of the community. The will of the people that is good for the community, they really want to be a part of it. They really want to participate. They really want to, kumbaya, hand in hand, everybody, get along just fine, sit in the daisies and do a wonderful thing. You know, there's no war, there's no countries, there's no rules. It's just, we all just decide, we're just going to get along. Sound familiar? Yeah, it sounds like what Marx was pushing with communism. And so that's the idea. However, we're not capable of it. We are unable to recognize it. But don't worry, said people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the other purveyors of the general will. We will recognize it, interpret it, and apply it for you through heavy government. Because right now, you're not capable of it, so we're going to force it on you through government until you guys are able to do it properly. Because we're going to change your behavior through our laws, our rules. That's the argument. Behavior change until you are capable of living in kumbaya without a heavy government. Then the heavy government will fade away. Same thing as communism. So the general will is a will of the people that the people don't recognize. They don't know it's out there. It's good for the community. It's good for everything else. It's just a matter of it being forced upon you by a ruling elite who is so wise and so intelligent that they not only recognize it, they can interpret it, and then they can properly apply it. Because, and this is a quote from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, sometimes man must be forced to be free. And so one of the people that bought into that was a guy named Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary of the United States. So the attack on our constitutional values, our constitutional principles, and this idea of laissez-faire and liberty and a free market system and all of that, and being able to be an individual, make your own individual choice, was under attack before the ink was even dry on the United States Constitution. So here we are now with this general will being pushed, and Alexander Hamilton is a part of it, and John Marshall becomes a part of it. John Marshall was the fourth Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. 1801, he gained a seat, and he's the one that's behind a lot of the problems when it comes to federal supremacy. Because in order for this to happen, the government must become so powerful that it controls everything, so that you can't make your own choices, so that you can't be the driver of your own lives. Liberty must be suspended for your own good. And that's kind of the attitude. Because you're an idiot. I said that earlier, right? They think you're an idiot. They think you're too stupid. You're not capable of running your own life, not at least in the way that they understand is to be proper. Therefore, you must be forced into their little box. And the wonderful thing about liberty is when you're in a system of liberty, you can be wrong. You can make mistakes. You can be a jerk, you can not be a jerk. You can be smart, you can be dumb. That's a part of liberty. And you know what? There are going to be people that are just like, we slap ourselves on the forehead and think, why in the heck do we even let them vote? And it seems like in today's society, that's most people. But if you're going to live in a system of liberty, system of freedom, you have to allow those people to also have their opinions and operate in the way they want to operate. Typically, what's going to happen is the better ways of doing things are going to work their way to the surface. That's what's going to innovate. That's what's going to become popular, and things will move in that direction. Typically. Of course, there's got to be a set of rules. Of course, there has to be governance. That's the whole reason for the Constitution. There has to be some type of government in place. And in the sense of our system, that government, the central government, the federal government, though, is not supposed to get involved domestically except for on a handful of things such as, the communication, between the states and being a mediator between disagreements between the states, in order to ensure domestic tranquility, things like that. Otherwise, internal issues are none of the government's business, the federal government's business. Because local government is supposed to take care of local issues. So you have local government, local issues, state government, state issues, federal government, federal issues. Federal issues supposed to be, for the most part, external issues or issues that have to do with promoting, preserving, and protecting the union, such as a postal service for the communication or being a mediator between the states in case there's a disagreement, like with the Commerce Clause. Otherwise, federal government handles only external stuff. So that's the idea. That is what was all created for. But understand that when Alexis de Tocqueville came here in the 1830s and he saw that everybody was pretty much taking care of their own business and that the rules were at a minimum, the laws were at a minimum, he was stunned. How is this possible? How is it that society is doing so well with so little government influence and interference? And he was amazed. And that is what spurred him to actually write a book called Democracy in America. Okay, I'm not real fond of the word democracy, but we'll go with it in this case. But he was amazed because the consent of the governed, allowing you to have consent of who's going to run your things locally and the decisions you're going to make locally and how you're going to operate locally and how you're going to have your roads locally. And it's all the local government that's deciding this and the people deciding this, not some centralized government that's overpowering and controlling everything. That was a stunner for him. It was a stunner that we were able to do that without going into chaos. So basically what I'm saying is when the federal government was created, and this was in practice in the early 1800s and the late 1700s, is that the federal government's influence on our lives, the influence on local magistrates or local governance was at a minimum. In fact, there's and I think we talked about this a few weeks ago on this broadcast. In Article 1, Section 4 or 5, I'm looking at it right now, Section 4. Article 1, Section 4, it says, Congress shall assemble at least once in every year. And there were actually those who thought that that was too often. Once a year? That's crazy. Because the authorities of the federal government were so few. Unless they were at war, the attitude was, why do we need to be at the Capitol? Why do we need to be in our seats in the legislature if we're not at war or there isn't some other international incident or situation going on? If we're not needed, we don't need to be there, and once a year might be too often. Now we've got these professional politicians that can't wait to be there, and they really live there. They don't even come back to their districts, and that's all they do is they sit there and they pass this law against you and that law against you and this law against you and that law against you, and you're constantly being bombarded by federal laws that are almost all unconstitutional, by the way. And so now as that happens, ultimately, what happens is the government becomes bigger and then it begins to centralize because it's like anything that grows. Government is like any organism. In order to grow, it needs to eat. And as it eats, it gets bigger. Well, what does the federal government eat? It eats liberty. It eats freedom. It eats our individualism so that it can control all of that. It's got to make room in its space to grow. And we are in the way. Our states are in the way. So state power, state sovereignty, state rights, as some people like to call it, our individual liberties and our right to make our own decision, that stands in the way. That is occupying a space that the government wants to occupy. So it must eat it and then expand into it. And that's what happens. The government keeps growing. Now, this idea that the federal government must be supreme in everything, the argument is that it exists, that it's allowed in Article 6 of the Constitution, Federal Supremacy Clause. The Supremacy Clause says, according to those who want a bigger government, want to push federal supremacy, that the Constitution says, hey, you know, that the federal government is supreme, and states can't have any laws contrary. You hear that all the time, right? And so, you know, when the state of California began to, for example, have its marijuana dispensaries, and I'm not necessarily in favor of the legalization of marijuana per se, but from a constitutional standpoint, what I'm getting ready to say is very true, that as the California was legalizing the marijuana dispensaries at the time under the idea of medical marijuana, which for California, and California has that authority. There is no authority regarding marijuana for the federal government. So there's no drug authority by the federal government. Each state can make their own decisions. But nonetheless, so as California was doing that, you were seeing these drug enforcement agency personnel from the federal government raid these facilities and shut them down. And I argued against that. Not because I'm necessarily a grand, excited, you know, supporter of the legalization of marijuana. I'm not. But from a legal standpoint, California had every right as a state to have those dispensaries. It was none of the federal government's business. They have no authority over drugs. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government has any authority over marijuana or any type of drugs. The FDA, in fact, is unconstitutional. Where in the Constitution does it give the federal government the authority to regulate food and drug? Should they? I don't know. Maybe that's something we need to study. But at the moment, they really don't have the authority. There needs to be an amendment giving them that authority. They were smart enough to have an amendment for prohibition to be in control of alcohol. Why do they not realize that or didn't realize that with drug and food? But nonetheless, there's no authority for what the federal government was doing. They're coming in and raiding these agencies, dispensaries, and it was totally unconstitutional. Well, the argument was federal supremacy. There's federal drug laws, and those dispensaries are in violation of the federal drug laws. And it says in Article 6, a state cannot have a law that's contrary to a federal law. That's not what it says. So let's read it now and figure it out. Before I get to the Federal Supremacy Clause, real quick, there is one other clause before it. I'm going to read that one first just because that's the order of the language in the Constitution, and I want to make sure it gets read in that order. So we have all debts contracted and engagements ordered into. This is Article 6. All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation. So in other words, what it's saying in that particular clause before we get to the Supremacy Clause is that anything that happened under the Articles of Confederation, agreements, debt, whatever, all gets transferred to the new government. In other words, the United States isn't going to skip out on their agreements just because they changed their system of government. The new government's going to honor the same agreements, the same engagements, the same contracts, the same debt as the old one did. It's just going to transfer over. Remember, before the government was created under the United States Constitution, our government of the United States was under the Articles of Confederation, and it was a different kind of government. In a confederation, the states held a lot more power. The central government had even less power. Matter of fact, they had almost no power, and it required a unanimous agreement of all the states in order to get anything done, and since Rhode Island seemed to disagree with everything, very little was getting done. So when they wrote this Constitution, they learned from that and created a whole new system. Now that that's done, now let's read the next part. Next part is the Supremacy Clause. It says, this Constitution, that's item number one, the Constitution, and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, item number two, and all treaties made or which shall be made, that's item number three. So we have these three items. We have the Constitution, we have the laws of the United States made in pursuance of the Constitution. In other words, laws of the United States that are authorized by the Constitution. If they're not authorized, they don't fit in this thing, whatever we're talking about here. So you have this Constitution, laws of the United States, made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States. Now, when it says under the authority of the United States, what it means is the process for a treaty to be ratified. A treaty can be negotiated by the president, it can be signed by the president. It does not go into force, however, until the United States Senate ratifies it, and that takes a two-thirds agreement on top of that. And when we have a president like Obama making agreements, quote-unquote, like the Iran agreement, that was a treaty. Any agreement with another country is a treaty, in my opinion, or at least its way should be treated, and it all should be ratified by the Senate. The whole point of the Constitution is not to allow any part of government, including the president, to make unilateral decisions, to make decisions without another part of the government or another part of the system or somebody else like the states saying it's okay. This check and balance system is throughout our system. And in the case of treaties, that check and balance runs through the Senate. And remember, our Senate used to be appointed by the state legislatures. The senators were not voted in, they were appointed by the state legislature, so it was a voice of the states. So our bicameral Congress had two different voices, the House of Representatives, voice of the people, they were democratically elected back then, just as they are today. But the United States senators, who are democratically elected today, were not originally democratically elected. They've changed that with the 17th Amendment. And originally, the state legislatures were appointing the United States senators. And that was a good thing, because that means that the senators' point of view on laws, on the lawmaking process, and on the job that the Senate had when it came to confirming appointments, ratifying treaties, and things like that, it gave the state legislatures the chance to have their point of view put into that process. Because these senators are not going to vote or operate in a manner that they think is best for the constituency of, in other words, we the people, but what's going to be best for the states, state legislatures, because that's who appointed them. So you have two different ways of looking at things. Two heads are better than one, they say. You know, it's an old saying, right? Two heads are better than one. Doesn't mean two of the exact same head. You might as well just have one head. But if you have the two heads, you want two different heads so that they look at things from a different point of view. It's a natural check and balance. So one might agree, the other one might not, because they look at it from a different point of view. If they both agree, then it's a good thing. But if one of them doesn't, it doesn't move forward. Simple as that. And that's kind of the basis of our system originally, is all these checks and balances. So the United States Senate ratifies the treaties, and this is important. Because of some of the language and the punctuation in this. Understand that every word, every comma, every period, every semicolon, every capitalization, everything is there for a reason the way it is. It's all important. It's all carefully placed in this Constitution the way it is. So now let me read this again, but I'm going to do something a little extra. I'm going to add the punctuation. This Constitution, comma, and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, semicolon, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. Then you got you another semicolon. So, semicolon is an interesting creature. It's an interesting piece of punctuation. Okay, so if you look it up in the dictionary, a semicolon, this is what Merriam-Webster dictionary says. It is a punctuation mark used chiefly in a coordinating function between a major sentence, between major sentence elements such as independent clauses of a compound sentence. In other words, we have the semicolon allows the sentence to continue because it's all a part of the same thing. However, it separates the clauses, and the clauses are, in other words, you have two independent but related clauses. So the clauses here that are related is that all three of them are part of this, are the supreme law of the land. However, there's a separation because of the word pursuance, made in pursuance thereof. The semicolon is there to separate treaties from that part. So the first two things before the semicolon are related under made in pursuance thereof, but it's not a period, it's a semicolon because all three of them are related when it comes to the supreme law of the land. So they need to be in the same sentence. So they're in the same sentence, but a semicolon is used so that the main pursuance thereof is separated from treaty. what this means, and once again, let me now go back to what this all really means when you start going through this, is that this sentence, this Constitution, number one, the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, number two, and all treaties made, number three, they're all the supreme law of the land once they are in place. Treaties, of course, like once again, has to go through the authority of the United States. In other words, must be ratified by the treaty. But because of that semicolon, made in pursuance thereof only applies to the laws of the United States, not to treaties. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, semicolon, and all treaties made. Now, then this is where my good friend G.R. Mobley, and I love him, and he's, you know, 99% of the time he's right on target. This is where he was in error last, about a week ago on my KMET program that's on the air on Saturdays from 1 to 3 Pacific. This is where he made an error. He talked about how the treaties, you know, when they don't follow the Constitution, they are illegal. And matter of fact, my co-host Dennis kind of caught on. He kind of said something about it, and he was right. And that's not true. So now, Doug, are you saying that treaties can be unconstitutional? That they can be outside what the Constitution allows for? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Why would the Founding Fathers do such a thing? I mean, look at the situation right now. If they were to ratify a treaty that took away all of our guns, then that would become the supreme law in the land. It would basically neutralize and eliminate the Second Amendment. Yeah, it would. It's a very dangerous thing. But the thing is, the Founding Fathers weren't worried about something like that, and they felt it was necessary because they recognized that there may be times when a treaty may need to be made in order to get something done that might be outside the Constitution. But they weren't worried because the final arbiters of the Constitution is not the judges, it's not supposed to be the judges. The final arbiters of the Constitution are supposed to be the states. And their oversight through the Senate was one way they could ensure that the Constitution was being followed. So in other words, they weren't worried about Congress passing unconstitutional laws. They didn't believe that the judges needed to have any power of judicial review where they could strike down unconstitutional laws, because Congress would be less likely to pass unconstitutional laws because the final arbiters of the Constitution, the states, had their voice in the Senate. And the Senate, being the voice of the states, being noble, politically savvy, but also men of sacred honor, would not allow unconstitutional laws to be in place, or at least that was the theory. Obviously, when you have man involved, when you have the human nature getting involved, the evil, the mistakes, the errors, the on purpose going against the Constitution, all that's going to be in play. But nonetheless, you know, there's no way you can force anything. You don't want to give any unilateral power to anybody. So you try to set it up so that the people who are supposed to be the final arbiters of the Constitution, the voice of the states, have the ultimate decision when it comes to treaties as well, and just because sometimes a treaty might need to be passed that isn't constitutional. So the state's voice ratifies the treaties in the Senate. A great example of that happening is the Louisiana Purchase. The federal government's not supposed to purchase property. The states are. Territories are supposed to belong to the states unless that property is gained through treaty, such as the spoils of war. And Jefferson knew this. So when the Louisiana Purchase came up, and it was like, man, what a deal, what an opportunity, what a great way to double the size of the United States, but I don't have the constitutional authority unless I negotiate it through treaty, because a treaty doesn't have to follow the Constitution, and as long as the Senate is ratifying it, that's the way to proceed forward, and that's what he did. The entire Louisiana Purchase was then negotiated by treaty, and that made it constitutional. It made it the supreme law of the land. The Louisiana Purchase was okay because it was done through treaty, and the Senate complied, and they ratified each of those treaties. But, see, he couldn't do it without the states okay through the Senate. So, once again, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof only... Now, let me stop there for a second. And the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof. I want to remind you again, only federal laws that are authorized by the by this U.S. Constitution are the supreme law of the land. If they're not, then they're not. It goes back to what I was talking about with the dispensaries. All federal drug laws, well, gun laws too, are unconstitutional. Therefore, a state can have law contrary to them because they're not supreme. Federal supremacy does not apply to unconstitutional laws. If it's repugnant to the Constitution, it's not a law. Or at least that's what John Marshall said in Marbury versus Madison. Typically, I'm not happy with Marbury versus Madison, but that statement in and of itself was exactly correct. So we have this idea now of federal supremacy. We're being told, no, federal government's supreme across the board. And someone like these lawyers that are out there saying, that's just the way it is. There's nothing you can do about it. Well, just because that's the way it is doesn't mean I have to just put up and shut up. If the federal supremacy is only supposed to apply to laws that are constitutionally authorized, then that's the way it should be. And that's what I'm going to fight for. So the Federal Supremacy Clause, this Constitution, the laws of the United States, which shall be made pursuant thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. So in other words, the judges have to follow this. They have to recognize that if the federal government is not authorized because the law is not made pursuant thereof, they can't take the case. And that means something like abortion or drugs or guns. The federal government can't take those cases. It's a state issue. It's up to the states to do it. Wait a second, Doug. Did you say guns, state issue? Does that mean the states then can stomp all over our gun rights? No. Now, while the Second Amendment only applies to the federal government, and every single federal gun law is unconstitutional, but the states are allowed to make gun laws, that does not mean that the states can just stomp all over your gun rights. Because your gun rights is not your gun right because it's in the Constitution, because it's in the Second Amendment. Your gun right is your gun right because God gave you that right. And the states are supposed to abide by that. They're supposed to abide by the fact that you have this natural right, this gift from God, to protect yourself. And it's not just guns, it's any weapon. You have a right to protect yourself against those who would seek to take away your liberty, your possessions, or whatnot. That's your right. You have a natural God-given right, and therefore you have a natural God-given right to keep and bear arms. That you shouldn't need to get a permit to carry a gun. The constitutional carry law, I think it's up to 24 states now in the country, follows that exact concept, that you can constitutionally carry regardless. Now, when we talk about this, I want you to understand that when it says then after that, anything in this Constitution, in the Constitution, or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So the Constitution cannot go contrary to the Constitution. You cannot go contrary to laws of the United States that are made in pursuance of the Constitution. And so, well, see, Doug, the gun laws that try to go with the gun control, that goes against the Constitution, goes against the Second Amendment. No, it doesn't. Because the Second Amendment applies to the federal government. It doesn't say that the states have to, so it's not contrary. It's contrary maybe to the concept, but not to the authority. The authority was given to the states. So the states do have the authority to make gun laws. But, that said, you have the natural right. So their laws are supposed to stop before it interferes with your natural right. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll read the rest of Article 6. I'll kind of reiterate some of what I talked about, and then get the rest of Article 6 and finish Article 7. And then we're going to talk about the signers a little bit and all of that, and then we'll wrap up. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hi, my name is Douglas V. Gibbs. I am known as Mr. Constitution out there, and I have been an instructor on the U.S. Constitution since 2008, and I've been studying the document my entire life. I have written 8 books out there, and the latest being Creator, the first 125 myths of the United States Constitution. All of the books, each of them have important messages to give. All of them are about the Constitution except for one of them. One of them is called Silenced Screams, Abortion in a Virtuous Society. That's my only non-constitutional book, and even it has a constitutional angle to it when you read it. All of them are available at douglasvgibbs.com/store. I would appreciate if you purchase the books. I would hope you would learn from them. All I ask is that in return you let me know, and I would love to autograph the books. If you buy them from the store, they will be autographed. So thanks for being a part of this program on K-Praise, and let's read about the Constitution and be informed.
Thank you. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled. You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. You know, I spent 20 years in the construction industry, and now that I'm no longer in the industry, I still feel like I'm always building. But instead of building homes or doing the things that make a home larger or better, I'm doing it with the constitutional education endeavor that I'm involved in. So we are currently building and enhancing what we do. All we need is help from you. Let us know what you think of the website as it grows. Send us an email at douglasvgibbs@ilj.com, or if you want to help fund our efforts, you can go to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com and hit the donate button and contribute to the effort. We want to make this as big as possible. We want to get the word out about the Constitution. We want it to spread to all the minds in this country so that we can turn this back around, restore our republic, restore our Constitution, and be back on the right footing. douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Radical, powerful, enlightening. The journey of America is a tale that needs to be heard. And Mr. Constitution tells it each week on the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs. Saturdays at 9 p.m. Pacific on K-Praise, San Diego's Salem Media radio station for Christian programming. FM 106.1 in North County, AM 1210 in San Diego, and online for the world at kprz.com. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back. Good to have you here. We've been talking about the Federal Supremacy Clause, and we've gone over it. We've talked about how this Constitution, the laws of the United States, made a pursuance thereof, and the treaties made or shall be, which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the states can't have laws that are contrary, and that the judges are bound to follow these rules. And what it comes down to is whether or not it's authorized. Who gets the authority? How is it supposed to happen? That's all a big part of it. So welcome back, Mr. Constitution Hour, Douglas V. Gibbs, here on K-Praise, kprz.com, and 1210 on the AM dial, 106.1 on the FM dial down in San Diego County, 1210 AM for San Diego and 106.1 for North County. Okay, now we are working our way through the Constitution, and we've talked about all of that. Now, let's get into what follows this Federal Supremacy Clause in the Constitution. Let's discuss that final paragraph before we get to Article 7. And here's what it reads. The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, that means municipal court and mayors, that means county courts, judges, and the members of the state, or the county supervisors, board of supervisors, all state, everything. Senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation. Oath or affirmation. Oath is to God, affirmation is not. There were those who believed that swearing to God was a sin, so they put in affirmation for those people. Oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. In other words, anyone that holds office, anyone that raises their right hand and says, I solemnly swear or affirm, they are bound to follow and appreciate and protect and preserve and support the United States Constitution. But no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. When we've got, and this happened with Amy Barrett, the judge justice on the Supreme Court that went through the confirmation during Trump's presidency, and I want to say it was Maxine Waters, maybe it was somebody else, but they said, or maybe it was Boxer. Actually, not Maxine Waters, she's House. I think it was Boxer, either Boxer or Feinstein, that says, your dogma of religion concerns me. That's none of your business. There's no religious test to hold an office. They can't say, oh, you have to be a Catholic, or you have to be a Christian, or you can't be a Christian, or gosh, you're just way too religious. That is unconstitutional. It doesn't matter what you believe. It's none of their beeswax. It's none of their business. That is your call. Now, obviously, the Founding Fathers expected us to be an honorable Christian society. That's what the foundation was. That's where the principles laid out were. So when someone says, oh, well, then what about Satanists, Doug? Well, first of all, I don't think they were expecting a bunch of Satanists to be running for office. But you know what? The way it's worded, yeah. It's none of our business. I don't want a Satanist or even a Muslim to put their political ideas, which completely stand against what the Constitution says, try to put those into play, but you can't keep them out due to a religious test. There are no religious tests. There's no exceptions. There's no asterisk there that says, well, unless they're a Satanist or something like that. Now, that said, if they do start pulling that stuff, we need to stop it, because if it's not constitutional, it's not constitutional, and it shouldn't go beyond their desk. And that's where that kind of thing gets stopped. But it all comes down to whether or not it's authorized, getting back to what we said earlier in Article 6. This Constitution and all laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof. Those are such key words. Made in pursuance thereof. And that applies here too. If someone is making law or supporting law that's made in pursuance of the Constitution, what does it matter what their religious affiliation is? And if they are going against the Constitution as being stopped because we're following the earlier part of Article 6, what does it matter what their religious affiliation is? So this religious test thing, now understand something else. This is the only place that religious test is mentioned. It only applies to those that are to hold office. It doesn't apply to anything else. So when, his name is Khan, I can't remember his first, I can't remember if that was his first or last name, but it was during the Democratic National Convention for President Obama, I think for the 2012 one, and this guy named Khan, who is a Muslim, holds up this blue covered constitution. He's waving it in the air, and he's arguing about how wrong Trump was having his limitations on travel into the United States from nine countries that were on the list, eight of which were Muslim, one was North Korea. But the Democrats acted like North Korea wasn't on the list. They were just all a bunch of Muslim countries, and that President Trump purposely did it for the purpose of, and actually originally they were all Muslim. North Korea got added later, but they were arguing, well, it's just because they were Muslim. Well, no, it was because that was where terrorism was being sponsored, was in those countries. In fact, the list came from Obama. And actually, this wasn't 2000. Yeah, this wasn't 2012. I'm sorry, it was 2000. It was 2012. I can't remember what it was the year, but it was regarding, you know, this limitation and saying that was unconstitutional because there shall be no religious test that says so in this Constitution. That was the argument. Yeah, I don't think it was 2012. Now I'm thinking about it. It was 2016, I think, and it was what Trump wanted to do. But nonetheless, the idea that him waving that constitution said, well, there's no religious test, so you can't keep someone from coming to the country because they're Muslim. Well, first of all, that wasn't what was behind what Trump wanted to do or what he did. It was what was behind it was the fact that those were countries that were sponsoring terrorism, number one. The fact that they were Muslim is, well, Islam tends to be the terrorist group of religion, whatever. But the other thing is this, even if it was his reason, even if he, you know what, a bunch of Muslims, we want Muslims, if that, what if that was what really was what he was saying? It still doesn't apply constitutionally. The U.S. Constitution only has religious testing here for office holders. So when it comes to immigration, if we want to say, hey, we don't want Muslims to immigrate in this country, we could do that. There's no religious test rule in the Constitution regarding that. It says that Congress may prohibit the migration for any reason. It doesn't give a detail in the Constitution, as in Article 1, Section 9, that it has to be a specific group or what, or it can't be a that's up to them. Religious test only applies to office holders. All right, let's continue. The Article 7, we've gotten Article 7. This is the final article of the original first part of the Constitution, you know, what you see on the wall at the Library of Congress, or I guess not on the wall, but or at the Independence Hall, actually. It's actually behind glass, kind of at a desk level. But it's actually 4 pages long. You know, we're presented the Constitution as a one-page document with a couple of columns. And in reality, it's a 4-page long document. But that's another story for another time. So Article 7 is all about the ratification. It says, the ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states. So ratifying the same. Establishment of this Constitution between the states and is requiring the ratification. What that means, what that does, is that establishes the Constitution as a compact, a contract. It is under contract law. In other words, when in law, contract law is different than other kinds of law, different than criminal law and corporate law and all that. Contract law is very specific. Either it's in the contract or it's not. That's the way contract law works. So when I talk about the authorities, the expressly enumerated powers, that's what I'm talking about. So it's and the ratification clause here, here in Article 7 really explains that. The ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states. The states are the party of the contract. So now, if they're the parties to the contract, then does that not make them the final arbiters of the contract? The courts were created by the contract. So they're not supposed to be the final arbiters. They are something that was created by the contract. The parties to the contract was not our federal judges. The parties to the contract was not the federal government. It was something created by it. The parties to the contract are the states, and the delegates of the states represented the states to do so. It is a contract. It is a compact between the states. They are the parties. And so they are the final arbiters of the Constitution. Then it says, done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day of September. Why isn't September 17th a national holiday? Why don't we just get rid of Labor Day and make it Constitution Day instead? Labor Day is based on, you know, Marxist communist foundation anyway. You know, power to the workers, right? The labor unions, all of that, that is a Marxist construct. Now, I'm not saying that I hate labor unions in the sense that I recognize for protecting workers' rights, at one point, they were absolutely necessary because corporate interests and companies and, you know, the greed of owners and all that needed to have a force to go against it. It's like anything in, you know, physics, you know, if you have a force, you need an equal and opposing force to stop it, right? So when you've got the corporate greed going on, you need that opposing force to stop it. That was the labor unions. But they're not labor unions anymore. Now they are money laundering machines for the Democrats, for the left, and it's not a good thing. But anyway, done a convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th day, only 12 states were present, Rhode Island wasn't there, 17th day of September in the year of our Lord, 1787, and in the independence, and of the independence of the United States of America, the 12th, in witness whereof we have hereunto submitted, subscribed our names. And then George Washington is listed as the president of the Senate. And then you've got 12 states. Once again, Rhode Island had withdrawn, did not send their delegates after all. But and you'll notice New York only has one signature, Alexander Hamilton. all the other states have two or more, and in order to have a vote, you required two or more. So when Robert Yates and the other, I think it was Edmund Randolph, I think it was. No, he was there. He just refused to sign it. But I can't remember who the other one was. But nonetheless, two of the delegates from New York got up and left when they realized they were going to write a new constitution. They wanted nothing to do with that. They wanted no part of a new constitution. They were there to fix the Articles Confederation. When they realized a new constitution, a new government was going to be created, they threw their hands up. They walked out, left Alexander Hamilton by himself to represent New York. And because he was by himself, he could debate, he could argue, he could do everything he wanted to do except for vote. His vote didn't matter because he was the only person representing his state, and they believed that there needed to be at least two in order for a state to be properly represented. And so, therefore, Alexander Hamilton's vote did not count. You'll also notice William Jackson was a secretary. And his notes, he took notes during the convention, as did James Madison. James Madison's being the best notes. That's what I studied. And then what's interesting is after the Constitutional Convention, years later, it comes out that James Madison, as much as he had the best notes, he had realized there was a few things he may not have gotten exactly right, or he'd forgotten, or he didn't write down. And so he actually conferred with the secretary's notes, William Jackson, and made adjustments to his own notes later. But nonetheless, even with that, James Madison's notes were recognized as being the best and most thorough notes of all of the founding fathers that were at that convention, the framers. And so his notes on the convention are the ones that have been followed the most and used the most for study. And in fact, that's one of the things that I studied. That's the reason why I know what I know about the Constitution, studying James Madison's notes. Anyway, so that's it. Thank you for spending the time with me over this last hour. We'll see you next week here on K-Praise. We are finished with the first seven articles. So next week, I'm going to talk a little bit about the ratification process of the Constitution. Then we'll get into the preamble to the Bill of Rights. And we'll talk a little bit about what was going on during that time and why, once again, the Christian principles of this country became important during that time. So thank you for listening. We'll see you here next week on K-Praise, KPRZ, KPRZ.com, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Odyssey. We're on like 8 or 9 or 10 different platforms. If you go to DouglasVGibbs.com, you can find a list of those platforms. I'm making sure that site's getting updated. And we'll see you next week. Have a great week. God bless. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.